So police have frequently confused and tricked people into confessing.
Hello, beautiful humans. I'm Tymie Castle.
And I'm Benjamin Mead.
And you're listening to Just a Minute. Just a Minute is an educational podcast where we break down justice topics in 30 minutes or less. Today's topic, the read technique. Hi, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Hello, Ben. What's up? How are you today? How's your semester going?
Jeez, why you got so many questions for me? Stop giving me the third degree.
Okay.
You know what the third degree is, or where the third degree comes from?
I actually always thought it had to do with third degree burns.
I mean, that makes sense. When I was thinking about that, I thought about that third degree. Oh, maybe it's burns.
I've always thought it was burns, and that's not true?
No. I mean, nothing that I read
came about burns.
Okay. But it could be, because actually there's some speculation. Nobody's 100% sure.
Okay.
But the third degree is an idiom that we use for like harsh questioning.
Right.
But it actually was a real police practice in the early 1900s. So the speculation of the origin comes from Freemasonry. So third degree, like if you're a third degree Mason, that's like the highest that you can get. And apparently like the trial or test for that is really intense. So at least in terms of etymology, that's the only one that I saw that was like, maybe it's this, it could be this. But the third degrees is officially defined as methods that inflict suffering upon a person in order to obtain information about a crime.
Yes.
So, yeah, I mean, it was routine for police to beat and torture suspects to get confessions. They held them for days without food, deprived them of sleep, beat them with rubber hoses or with sandbags because those don't leave marks.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Interesting. I never thought about that.
Yeah. And obviously this became increasingly controversial, and there was a great deal of public outcry about this, and Herbert Hoover commissioned the Wickersham Commission, which was instrumental in abolishing the third degree as a standard police practice.
Well, I think I actually have a copy of the Wickersham report somewhere in my office. I think I got one free in a library giveaway where they were just giving away old things. Nobody wanted it, apparently.
Interesting.
Okay, so, well, since police can't beat it out of people anymore, how do they get people to confess to crimes?
Well, they have to rely on their wits and hard-boiled ability to outmaneuver clever criminals and get them to spill their guts. Or, as we have talked about in numerous vigilante and superhero episodes, just call in Batman to beat a confession. Police can't do it officially. We need a vigilante or a superhero.
Yes, we do.
But one particular and increasingly controversial method of custodial interrogation used by police is called the read technique, and that's R-E-I-D.
Yeah, I really drew that out in the intro. Read.
Yeah. So even if you haven't heard of read technique or heard it called this, you're probably familiar with the core principles because you've probably seen it in police TV shows or even documentaries.
I think Law and Order is pretty well known for this
in
those scenes with the police interrogation.
Basically, the image of like a sweating, shaky person in a small dark room under the lights of a hot lamp or like sterile fluorescent lighting with a detective shouting, "Just admit what you did." That's the read technique, basically. Yes. And before we go any further, one of the main critiques of the read technique is that it's coercive and leads to false confessions.
Imagine that. Imagine that.
But I want to do another episode only on false confessions. So I'm not going to talk too much today about the broader problem of false confessions, but certainly coercive police interrogation tactics is one of the main reasons for false confessions.
Yes, because I would totally confess if I had like a lamp beating down on me and was isolated in a room if people were screaming at me. I'd probably just confess to something.
Or being deprived of food.
We know you get hangry. Of food, I get real hangry. I was hangry today, actually. So
yeah.
Okay, so tell us more about the read technique. Where did it come from?
The read technique was created by a Chicago PD officer and polygraph examiner named John Reed, and he developed this in the 40s and 50s, and the first manual was published in 1962. So he's got a company now, Johnny Reed's and Associates. Associates, and he actually sells these training programs and manuals about Reed to police departments.
Of course he does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so he's got a website, he's got a YouTube channel. You can order these trainings, you can order these videos, and I'll give you some more details about this later, but I found like a worksheet packet for the Reed technique. I imagine it's something that the police would be riding on as they're having one of these seminars, like fill in the blank here for an example of this. And there's some good things from that I'll tell you about later.
Okay.
But it's self-proclaimed as the most widely used approach to interrogation in the world. And even if police don't officially buy this training or participate in this training, the practices and ideas of Reed is so pervasive in law enforcement in the U.S. that it's passed down kind of informally through training and shadowing and socialization and those types of things.
Right. Learning on the job.
Right.
So how's it done? If I want to Reed technique someone, how do I do it?
Well, we talked about profiling recently.
Yes.
But before you even begin the interrogation proper, you start with a behavioral analysis interview, BAI, which is supposed to be non-confrontational, and the suspect may not even know they're a suspect, but you kind of start friendly and warm to see if there are any signs of suspicion, kind of like the Columbo. You remember Columbo? Like he plays dumb and asking questions and, you know, all shucks, and then he's walking out of the room and he stops and he's like, oh, one more thing. And then he drops the hammer on him. So based on this BAI, if the police believe you to be guilty, then they proceed with the interrogation phase. And this is kind of based on Reed's polygraph experience. He was a polygrapher or whatever. So this BAI is supposed to provide indicators of guilt that the police are supposed to be looking for, like avoiding eye contact or fidgeting or slouching or shifting posture or delayed responses or fumbling with jewelry or lack of eye contact.
Things that I do every day because I can't sit still that I'm doing right now. I'm playing with my fingers and fidgeting while we're recording this podcast.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of based on this pseudo faulty science. But the Reed manual says, based on that assumption, that these are effective indicators of guilt, that means that only guilty people are interrogated, and this BAI is effective at ruling out innocent suspects.
My comment here is that BAI is nothing but BS.
Yeah, totally. Obviously, there are lots of problems with the Reed technique, and we've not even started about talking about it proper. But this is one of the fundamental flaws of the whole thing that, you know, first of all, these are accurate indicators of guilt and deception. You said you were just sitting here doing those, fiddling with your jewelry or shifting posture. That was a big one. Like, you know, a honest person sits still, and if you're guilty, you move. Like, I've got long legs and I'm constantly
fidgeting.
I'm a wiggler. I wiggle all the time.
And you're going to be nervous if somebody's like bearing down on you or you're taking a polygraph. It's just it's the environmental cues that make you nervous.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we've talked before about I'm like a goody two shoes.
Yes.
And if I was being questioned by the police, I would be sweating and I would be nervous and I would be anxious. And, you know, I feel totally guilty because I just told you I ran a red light. Like, I just did a horrible, terrible thing.
You just admitted it on the podcast,
too. Mm-hmm. And so I would, like, being questioned by the authority, being questioned by the police, you would be nervous even if you are a goody two shoes.
Yes.
And the other thing about this is that the Reed technique makes police think that they're human lie detectors.
Right.
So, like, you do this and you can, like, sniff out liars. But police are not better at detecting lying than the average person. And there's lots of studies that show this. So, you know, psychological studies set up police don't do any better than the average person at being able to accurately spot when someone's lying versus telling the truth.
Okay, so what about the interrogation process?
Yeah, so once you know the suspect is guilty, it's time to get to work and get a confession.
Yes.
And there are basically 9 steps the Reed technique.
That's a lot.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to go through all 9 of them.
But it's a good thing this is 30 minutes or less. We've got time.
Yeah, the first one is direct, positive, presentation or confrontation. So you're the nice, sweet, person in the pre-interview, and then the first stage is you drop the hammer. You confront the suspect and say, you know, we know you did it. We know how you did it. And interrogators are encouraged to use deceptive tactics here, like bringing in a huge empty binder full of empty pieces of paper. Like, this is all of the evidence that we have against you, or even using false evidence or false witness statements. So We know you did it. You're, you know, co-conspirators in the next room, and he spilled his guts. So you better just go ahead and admit what you did. And one of the funniest, I mean, obviously that's not funny, but one of the funniest like fake evidence things that I saw, I read about these police officers who had this guy, and they were trying to question him. And so they took him into the copy room, and they had a piece of paper in the copy machine that said, "You're lying." And they basically took a spaghetti strainer colander and put it on his head and had like a wire going to the copy machine. And every time they thought he was lying, they would just hit the copy button on the copy machine and it would spit out, "You're lying, you're lying." So, oh, I mean,
poor guy.
Yeah. It's encouraged to use these kind of deceptive tactics when you kind of confront, say, like, okay, we know you did it.
What is number one, is this also the good cop, bad cop part that you hear about with the Reed technique, where you're nice and then the other one's not nice, one's nice, one's not nice, and they go back and forth?
Well, so not exactly. But if you were doing the good cop, bad cop, this would definitely be the bad cop. So you can do the Reed technique as one person.
Okay.
Or you can do like the good and the bad.
Okay.
But if you're just one person, this is the bad cop phase.
Gotcha.
Or this would be the bad cop, where you like, in your face, we know you did it. And then the next stage is theme development. And that's when maybe the good cop would come in. Or if you're doing the questioning alone, then you kind of start switching tactics. So first is like, scare them, we know you did it. And the second is called theme development. You start developing these themes and provide them a moral excuse and kind of a face-saving explanation that allows them to minimize their guilt. So you put the blame on someone else or some other circumstance. And one of the interesting parts of this whole technique is that really the detectives provide the story. They provide the facts, and what you're trying to do is get the suspect to agree to that.
So like, it just got out of hand.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't mean to do that. And then you're hoping that the suspect like nods their head or something.
Yeah. Or we know you're guilty. We have all this evidence and there's no question, but I get it.
Yeah.
You know, if she was talking to me like that, I would lose my temper too.
Yeah.
Or you really needed money.
Right.
Everybody understands why you would do this. So you start, dropping these things that give them a way to kind of like manage their guilt and to a degree help them kind of still think of themselves as a, quote unquote, good person.
Gotcha.
Number three is stopping denial. So, reject any attempt to deny guilt or cut them off. And again, remember the detectives provide the story.
Mm-hmm.
And so in the Reed technique, your goal is to basically keep the suspect from talking as much as possible. Like literally the manual says, if they start to say something or if they start to say they didn't do it, cut them off. Don't let them say that. It's easier to get a confession if you prevent them from saying out loud that they didn't do that. And that was like in that worksheet, like cut them off. Don't let them say it out loud. Number four is overcoming objections. So you dismantle the explanations why the suspect can't be guilty. So it's like, I know you did it. We know you did it. And, they say like, oh, I couldn't have done it. I didn't need the money. I've got plenty of money. So then you take that and you, say why that doesn't matter or that's not effective. So you say you don't need the money. We have your bank records. I know you needed the money. Or maybe you don't need the money, so that just means it was kind of a spur of the moment type of thing. You didn't plan it out. Or again, you can kind of turn it or twist that like, well, I hope that's true that you don't need the money, because if you do, that means you, planned it out, and that makes you even more guilty and that makes it even more worse. So whatever kind of objections they provide, overcome that.
Gotcha.
Number five is getting the suspect's attention. So you want to keep them engaged, like make them engaged and pay attention. If you're questioning them and they're starting to disengage, you've got to pull them back in. And so this is like, be sincere, like sit close to them, touch them, do something to make sure that they know you're sincere and they're engaged. And then number six, the suspect sits quiet and listens. So pull them back in, keep eye contact, manage their mood, and again, keep them passive. And that worksheet, this is one of my favorite quotes, the worksheet actually says, if they're crying here at this stage, that means they're guilty.
Or they're just scared and terrified and want their mommy.
Yeah. Number seven is the alternative. So this is where really the good cop, bad cop thing comes in.
Gotcha.
You provide two explanations for the crime. One of them is morally reprehensible and one of them is not as threatening and more acceptable. And you stress one and you try to get them to choose between the two. But then again, the insidious thing here is it's a choice between two. Either way, you're guilty. You know, so this just sets up like you're guilty or you're... Yes. Still guilty, but it's not as bad. So pick the not as bad one. And you lead them towards the good explanation. Like, I think this was done for a good reason. And again, the detectives do most of the talking. They provide the story. They provide the facts. And you're just trying to get them to say, like, yes, that's what happened. Or agree to what you said. So you accuse the person. You block any denial. You offer them excuses for why they did it. Say, you know, we know why you did it. We understand why you did it. You know, just agree with what you said, just agree with what we say. You don't let them talk. You don't let them deny it. Just kind of create this perception that there's no way out except to confess and agree with what you say. And so then you, this is where you get them to agree. They say, okay, yeah, I did it. And then stage number 8 is bringing them into the conversation. So after you get them to admit it, then is when you start letting them talk. Don't let them talk until they admit it. Then once they've agreed, you kind of reinforce that. So like, thank you for admitting to this. We know you did it. I understand. I knew that was the case all along. And then get them to kind of fill in the blanks, get them to tell the story you've created and obtain corroborating evidence. And then finally, number 9 is the confession. Convert this conversation into written format and get their signature.
Beautiful. Mm-hmm. All right. So now we've got a guilty person.
Yep.
And we got their signature. Yep. Saying they're guilty. And we get them to confess.
Mm-hmm.
What's the problem with that?
Well, lots of problems here. But I'll start the official critique of the read technique by saying, like, even over and above the read technique, there's lots of incentives for police to get a confession. If you get a confession, it can save you a lot of work. It's
right.
Easier to get a confession than to do investigation, you know, collect evidence. I just watched the new Jussie Smollett documentary last night.
Yeah.
And I mean, it was mind-boggling how much effort and work the police put into like tracking the suspects back to their house through like video cameras in CCTV, in Ring cameras, like how much manpower and hours and time that would take. You get a confession.
Yep.
You don't, you know, like it's easy way to get out of some
right,
work.
Right.
And it's also one of the most powerful pieces of evidence in a criminal trial. For example, in 1992, a 17-year-old signed a confession under coercion to a double homicide. Turns out he was actually in jail at the time the crime was committed. And so at his trial, his defense attorney presented the jail logs, the jail records, had a officer who worked in the jail testify this guy was in jail when the crime was committed. The prosecutor presented the confession. Which do you think the jury believed?
The confession?
Yeah, the confession.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah. So, yeah, he was, you know, convicted and sent sent to prison for this double murder.
What a waste of the court's time. Because that should have knocked the case out. It should have been a trial.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. So a confession heavily outweighs other exculpatory evidence.
Right.
But back to Reed specifically, 3 major critiques. First of all, it's unduly coercive.
Imagine that.
Yeah. It's a coercive situation, and it causes you to feel all kinds of things. Anxiety from the isolation and intimidation, fatigue from lengthy interrogations, despair from confrontation. You're getting hounded and like mercilessly and relentlessly. We know you did this. We know you did this. Just admit it. And then hope from the themes and stories developed by the interrogator that imply leniency. One article that I read said, you know, in this process, like confrontation brings despair and then minimization offers a lifeline. So it's this intense confrontation by authority figures that can even break down innocent people.
Yes.
As well as guilty. And under these circumstances, it's easy to see how the short-term benefits of confessing and getting this to stop outweigh the long-term consequences.
Right.
And a lot of times these short-term consequences are emphasized. Just tell us what happened and you can go home.
Yes.
We'll stop hassling you. This will be over. Just tell us what happened and everything will be okay.
Right.
And then, of course, it heavily employs deceit and manipulation. And remember, interrogators are encouraged to use false evidence and to provide the story. So, you know, maybe you have a theory of how the crime went down, but you're the one that's providing the story, not the person who committed the crime. So that's kind of inherently deceptive and can create, you know, problems of accuracy. So police have frequently confused and tricked people into confessing. And particularly if, like, for someone who don't remember, police will say, like, oh, maybe you don't remember, but isn't it possible you were there? Isn't it possible you did this? So there was a case in Texas where the police were interviewing somebody from a crime that happened 10 years ago. You know, so they're asking, like, you know, where were you on this day 10 years ago? And who on earth would be able to say that?
You know.
And this guy just kept saying, like, I don't know. I don't remember anything. And the police officers kept being like, well, isn't it possible you were on this street? Well, I don't know. I don't remember. But it's possible. And he'd be like, yeah, it's possible. You know, isn't it possible that you were in the same place as the victim? I don't remember. And, it, you know, it just kept going. And, like, this went on for 2 days.
Oh, my goodness.
And eventually the interrogator, like, made the guy say, okay, say you're sorry. And the guy's like, I'm sorry, but I didn't do anything. He was like, no, say you're sorry. Just say you're sorry. And so basically he didn't remember. He didn't do it.
Yes.
But because he couldn't remember where he was 10 years ago, the detective seized on that and basically got a confession out of him, and he goes to prison for 15 years. And in another case, police in Canada in 1996 got a man to confess by convincing him that he'd blacked out and he couldn't remember. So basically, you did this, you don't remember it just because you blacked out and got a, yeah. So, and this technique can also lead to contamination. So as police are providing their story, they can inadvertently introduce evidence that the suspect then regurgitates back to them and they take as proof.
Right.
So that kind of last piece, after you get them to admit and get them to say their own story, you're looking there for details that, you know, show that they really did it. And in one case I was listening to about, they were, you know, questioning, you know, someone who was about a murder, and there were some, like, credit card receipts. And this was basically like a you know, a homeless woman with, you know, health problems. And, you know, they I forget the exact details, but these credit card receipts were really important. So they were, like, showing her the credit card receipts. She's like, no, 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 no. And then of course they get her to confess. And then she starts telling the details of, like, how much money was spent and what stores she visited after this. And they were like, oh, yeah, she provided all of these details, but she just looked at the credit card receipts they showed her.
Right.
And then they were like, oh, yeah, she knows all these things that she wouldn't know otherwise.
Jeez.
And then finally, there's the big problem of purpose. So fundamentally, the purpose of the Reid technique is to get a person to confess and not to discover the truth.
Right.
So Reid creates tunnel vision. It, like, narrows the police's vision, their minds, and their goals, rather than keeping them open to alternative evidence or stories or theories. So we've got to get a confession from this person instead of, we got to get at the truth. We got to figure out what happened. And I'm sure you've seen the documentary American Nightmare on Netflix. Like, you can see this really well in this documentary. So basically, a woman is kidnapped by a serial killer in a wetsuit, essentially in front of her boyfriend.
Right.
And is repeatedly sexually assaulted over the next few days. And her boyfriend go to the police, but the police don't believe him. They're not interested in what he has to say. Like,
it sounds too fantastic.
There is that element. I mean, that does sound a bit like, yeah. But they never even entertain the idea that this is a possibility.
No.
So he's trying to tell them, you know, what happened, and they just, like, repeatedly shut him down. You know, we know you did this. We know you dumped her body in the lake by the house. You all had a fight. Just admit what you did, for days while she's being sexually assaulted. So, you know, the Reid technique kept them from even considering the truth, considering the possibility here.
Which, I mean, I guess we should say that, by the way, he releases her. And she comes back, and then they turn it on the victim by thinking that they just committed a hoax and made the whole thing up.
Yeah, so the victim shows up days later and is like, yeah, this is what happened to me. And they don't believe her either. They think she's making it up, and she's the, you know, Gone Girl, that you know, book and movie. So she's the modern-day Gone Girl. Yeah,
and it was that one outrageous police officer from a different district who was the only one that believed her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And if not for that, who knows what would happen. Mm-hmm. Anyway, okay. So obviously, lots of problems. What do we do?
Well, the Reed company staunchly defends its technique and says that if it's done properly, the Reed technique protects against false confessions. And it says, like, detectives using bad techniques or not using Reed properly, that's what creates the false confessions. And honest people are immune to the Reed technique.
They got to protect their brand.
Yeah, exactly. It's important to remember that the Reed company is making money from this product. So they're trying to defend their technique. They're citing court cases that uphold technique. They advertise the prevalence of their technique, minimize false confessions. And so they talk about, like, you know, satisfaction rates and confessions rates obtained and admittance rates and all of these things. But they have been somewhat responsive to some of the major critiques of the Reed technique.
Okay.
And they have instituted some changes in their process and in their manual. So first of all, they say don't interrogate someone who doesn't remember. Don't try to confuse them or create false memories.
Okay.
Yeah. Number two, now they say don't use Reed on juveniles or those with diminished capacity because those people are particularly prone to false confession.
Right.
There's like a lack of understanding. They're, you know, have an eagerness to comply with authority, to pass in social situations that they don't understand. I want to talk more about that when we do like a full false confession episode.
Okay.
But don't use Reed on juveniles or people with diminished capacity.
No.
Get corroborating evidence from the confession, new evidence unknown to the police, and then record interrogation. So now, you know, there's been some hesitancy on police to record interrogations, but Reed now endorses that. But these don't really kind of change the fundamental problem of the technique, and specifically, you know, Reed technique and lying to suspects is banned in many countries, including Canada and Europe.
So are there other options or models to use for questioning suspects?
Yeah, absolutely. The PEACE model is a great alternative. And the PEACE model was created in England in the 1980s after several high-profile cases involving false confessions. So it's an acronym, P-E-A-C-E. P is for preparation and planning. So police develop a written plan and create goals for questioning ahead of time, before the interrogation, before the interview. E stands for engage and explain. So you explain your goals and your planning to the suspect, build some rapport, build some trust. A stands for account clarification and challenge. And this is the main part of the interview. And in contrast to Reed, here you get the suspect side of the story. Use active listening. And it's not like this is just like, oh, nice, sweet, tell us what happened. Like the police, they're still challenging them. They're still presenting you know, facts and evidence. The account is still challenged. It's still confrontational, but the suspect provides the story, not the police. And the use of deception and false evidence is limited and prohibited.
Gotcha.
C is for closure. After the suspect gives their narrative, then you summarize their statement. Let them correct any discrepancies or make any clarification. The interview's over. And then finally, E is for evaluation. Compare and contrast their statement with other evidence in the case and evaluate the interview. And specifically, it says, focus on content, what they said, and not their behavior. So, you know, like, don't focus on if they were sweating or not, or if they were shaking or not, or if they were fiddling with their jewelry. Like, those are not indicators of guilt. Those are indicators of anxiety.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Is that all?
Well, I mean, a big difference is that, and I mentioned this before, PEACE suspect do most of the talking. In Reed, you try to keep the suspect from, you know, doing as much talking as possible. And there's some research that suggests that PEACE leads to more confessions and better confessions and definitely fewer false confessions.
Got it.
And that's all I got.
Okay, good.
Mm-hmm, yep. So that means it's our minute to spin it, where we both give our takeaway from the show today. So Tommy, in just a minute, what's your spin?
My spin is short and simple. The science shows that there are no reliable behavioral signs of deceit that humans are able to detect, and this includes with the use of technology. One newer study on AI showed the ability to detect subtle differences, but the accuracy was still pretty low. So in other words, we can't do this. We're not human lie detectors, and the Reed technique is bunk.
Mm-hmm.
Ben, what's your spin?
Don't read. Reading is bad. Instead, make peace. So who would have thought we would be discouraging reading on a justice podcast? So I thought about doing a limerick here.
Yes.
Because I can think of a really good word that rhymes with interrogate. But this is a clean podcast. Okay. So instead, I'll just stick with, hey, kids, don't read. So we need to recognize the problems with the read technique and deception and interrogation. And we definitely don't want people to confess to a crime that they didn't commit. And read results in false confessions. And we and the police should not be so much interested in getting a confession, but in getting the truth. And that's the truth.
We are a community-driven podcast sponsored by the Gandhi Center and produced by JMU Libraries. Check out our website, linked in show notes, to see how you can support our educational programming.